Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Italian academic Umberto Eco drew on his extensive library, notebooks, clippings, and scholarly articles to write The Name of the Rose, his first best-selling novel. For his sixth and newest, Eco says he used literature to tell the truth and uncover an historical fraud. The novel has stirred controversy for its portrayal of an immoral anti-Semite, the only fictional character among a host of 19th century historical figures. The title of his book is The Prague Cemetery. And Umberto Eco joins me in the studio. We do invite you to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning.
Good morning, Dan.
It's good to have you here. I wonder, just to open this program and introduce our listeners to the Prague Cemetery, if you would read for them the letter you wrote to your readers a year ago.
It is not in the book. It was requested by the press office of my American publisher. Dear reader, the 19th century teemed with mysterious and horrible events. The protocols of the Elders of Sion, the notorious forgery that later inspired the Dreyfus case, Hitler, and numerous intrigues involving the secret services of various nations, Masonic sects, as Jesuit conspiracy, as well as other episodes that, were they not documented truths, would be difficult to believe. The Prague Cemetery is a story in which all the characters, except one, the main character, really existed. Even the hero's grandfather, the author of a mysterious actual letter that triggered modern anti-Semitism, is historical. And the hero himself, though fictional, is a personage who resembles many people we have all known, past and present. In the book, he serves as the author of diverse fabrications and plots against the backdrop of extraordinary coup de théâtre, sewers filled with corpses, ships that explode in the region of an erupting volcano, abbots stabbed to death, notaries with fake beards, hysterical female satanists, the celebrants of black masses, and so on. I am expecting two kinds of readers. The first has no idea that all these things really happened, knows nothing about the 19th century literature, and might even have taken Dan Brown seriously. He or she should gain a certain sadistic satisfaction from what will seem a perverse invention, including the main character, whom I have tried to make the most cynical and disagreeable in all the history of literature. The second, however, knows or senses that I am recounting things that really happened. The fact that history can be quite so devious may cause this reader's brow to become lightly bedded with sweat. He will look anxiously behind him, switch on all the lights, and suspect that these things could happen again today. In fact, they may be happening on that very moment, and he will think, as I do, they are among us.
Umberto Eco, reading from his letter to readers about his new book, The Prague Cemetery. Your main character, Simone Simonini, hates everybody.
Everybody.
everybody and everything, and you grew up hating as well.
No. You mean if I grew up hating who? The Simoninis?
No. You grew up, as you've written elsewhere, you grew up hating people, hating Jews, hating Italians, hating everyone.
Simonini. Not me.
No, I have read that about you as well.
It is exactly the contrary, if you want, because since I was educated as a child under the fascist dictatorship, when I went out of that nightmare, and I was so happy that it happened when I was 11 years old.
Exactly.
And so I was able to understand the difference.
But early on, as being raised within that kind of regime and under that kind of...
Then you are totally transformed when we escape from that. And so that's why I devoted my life to hate dictatorships and racism and everything, because... you know, for a young man, it's a great shock and epiphany to be educated for at least the first 10 years of my life to learn that you have to die for your country, that Mussolini was your father, and so on and so forth. And suddenly, at the radio, we knew that Mussolini was kicked off. And the day after, my mother said, go to the newsstands to see if there are newspaper, because with this earthquake, we don't know. And the old newspaper were no more there. There were new newspapers. And speaking of the Christian Democrats, of the Socialist Party, of the Communist Party, of the Liberal Party. And so I understood that all that people, it's impossible they were invented overnight. So they existed before, but they were repressed. They didn't exist. They were in a clandestine way or in another country. And I understood what a dictatorship is, a sort of repression of everything else. And I saw suddenly, one morning of July 43, all that to blow up, that changes the life of young men.
It really, really does. But Simone Simonini may have an alter ego, or he may have another part of himself that he is facing. It's a fascinating but confusing understanding of how this man is thinking, what he is thinking, how he is living.
Well, he has a split personality, okay, also because at that time in Paris there were many, many psychiatrists and eminently Charcot studying the split personality. I followed exactly all the clinical reports to give a split personality either to my dying home and also to Simonini, because I think that a professional forger who spent his life saying always the contrary of what he believes has a split personality. And... well, but Simonini is, if you want, a sort of atomic pile of hatred. It's a condensation of all possible hatred. But there is a lot of people who are by nature intolerant. They cannot stand who is different, whom is different. So That's why Simonini hates the Jews, hates Germans, hates Italians,
he
French.
Hates everybody. He yes. hates the Poles. He hates the Vatican.
But, you know, all the his sentence apropos of Jews, of Germans, are not invented by me. They are pre-existing cliché. The end part of the anti-German invective is Nietzsche. Great philosopher who didn't like his own countrymen. The anti-Jews part is Céline, the notorious anti-Semite French writer from a book, Bagatelle pour un massacre, that now cannot be published because the widow is stopping this book because it's so violently racist that she wants to, in a way, to protect the memory of his husband, who was so overtly racist that there is very little to protect. But in any case, those pages were so incredible that the widow tries to put them aside.
Tell me about the letter that is at the center of this novel.
That is an historical fact. At the end of the 18th century, after the French Revolution, a reactionary abbot, the abbot Baruel, wrote a book to demonstrate that the French Revolution was due to a plot of Knight Templars, philosophers of the Encyclopédie, and so on and so forth. An interesting case of plot paranoia. But he was not mentioning the Jews.
All right, and we'll finish that story when we come back. I look forward to hearing your comments. And welcome back. Umberto Eco is here in the studio. Just before the break, we were talking about the letter that is at the center of his newest novel titled The Prague Cemetery. Please continue.
So I was telling this abbot Baruel wrote a book at the end of 18th century to demonstrate that the French Revolution was the result of a plot made by the Templars, the philosophers of the Encyclopédie, and so on and so forth. At that point, he received a letter from a Captain Simonini of Florence, about whom we don't know anything else except the existence of that letter, and even that letter can be a forgery. But the letter was full of all the anti-Semitic cliché. He say, "You have forgot the influence of the Jews on the French Revolution," and he explains all the I mean, all the 19th century anti-Semitism was summarized in this letter that circulated and circulated with the secret police of the French government. It was circulating among the Jesuit journals. And it had an enormous influence. Even we don't know anything else about this Captain Simonini and about the origin of the letter. So in my novel, I introduced that old Simonini, an old reactionary, or as they were saying at that time, ci-devant, with the nostalgia of the French monarchy and so on and so forth, and of his grandchild, who is the protagonist of my story, that was whose mind was shaped by the racism and the reactionary thought of his grandfather.
Going back to the reality of this letter, how did it come to influence Hitler as he came to power?
No, the letter influenced a lot of offsprings of anti-Semitism of various kinds. Some are quoted in my novels, different books, and so on. And step by step, there was, but even there we don't have absolute evidence, a slow concoction of the protocols of the Elders of Zion. My novel is entitled The Prague Cemetery because the Prague Cemetery was a fictional invention of a German spy, Hermann Goetze, who told that story of the rabbi of over the world gathering in the Prague Cemetery to plan the conquest of the world. One of my contributions to the history of the protocols was that I think to have been the first one to discover the main source of that in a novel, in a popular novel of Alexandre Dumas, Joseph Balsamo, where they are not the rabbis, they are the Freemasons, but the pattern is the same, gathering in order to plan the French Revolution. So you see that you use always the same pattern for different enemies. This fictional story immediately was republished by many journals, even in Russia, as a real one. To such an extent that Goetze signed his book as John Ratcliffe, okay, it was a pen name, but in the course of the events, John Ratcliffe became the name of the chief rabbi in the Prague Cemetery. So it was an immense growing up of a cliché. And the Prague Cemetery, story of the Prague Cemetery, influenced the concoction of the protocols. But not only this source, but many other sources. I'm used to say that the protocols are like a Frankenstein monster made up with pieces of different corpses. And in fact, we know only that they were published in Russian in 1905. But what happened before is still a matter of historical controversy. They certainly started in France, but with Goethe and therefore with German influence. And then step by step, there were Russian secret agents that used it and so on and so forth. So in my fiction, obviously, I attribute everything to Simonini in order to make it more evident. Otherwise, I would have written an essay, an historical essay. But there are already many beautiful and important historical essays on that story. I wanted only to dramatize it, even though, you know, it was not enough to write excellent historical books like Warrant for a Genocide of Norman Cohn and others to convince people of that forgery. And so maybe a novel can be more convincing and can reach a larger audience.
Why do you think the Vatican has come out with such a negative reaction to your book?
Listen, first of all, it's difficult to say the Vatican is the newspaper of the Vatican, which by in the last years has become very, very extreme right and close to Berlusconi. So it's another story. I am not so loved by the Italian government. And they were irritated, not because of the Jews, but because of the Jesuits, and because of themselves, because the Osservatore Romano was ferociously anti-Semite the last century. Now, obviously, isn't. And in my book, where I tell the historical truth, the Pope, Leon the 13, looks as a madman because he took seriously the hoax as produced by a certain Leo Taxil. So it seems it's incredible, but he believed the most incredible inventions. So they were irritated, but they couldn't defend the anti-Semitism of the Osservatore Romano of the last century. So they told me, you are defamating Jews. That's nice.
I want to go back for a moment to your early years under Mussolini and how you believe that has affected your thinking, your outlook, your view of the world.
You know, you should read my previous novel, The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana, which is exactly the story of a young man who grew up in that period. If you don't remember the story, is a man who lose his what is called personal memory. He remembers that Julius Caesar was assassinated and Napoleon, but he doesn't remember who is the name of his wife, which is a typical clinical situation. And so he goes in his countryside house, in which in the cellar or in the last floor, he has all the memory of his childhood, the comic books he read, the newspapers collected by his grandfather. And so step by step, he recovers his memory by reading all that material. And that material depicts the way in which a young man at that time was educated. I remember to have discovered the freedom of press and many other things that the dictatorship was not mentioning by reading Walt Disney. Mickey Mouse journalist was a revelation. He was fighting for the freedom of the press. And it was the only text that told me that freedom of the press existed. Otherwise, I didn't know it. So even the comic books played an important role of the re-education of a young man, even during the dictatorship.
You know what's fascinating? You said this young man had lost his memory. Simonini has suddenly lost his memory.
No, it's another phenomenon. It's a split personality, scientifically speaking.
But he says that the way he is going to regain his memory is to write.
Right, because
to write everything that he can remember.
That's due to a little suggestion of Dr. Freud.
Exactly, and Freud.
Because he meets Dr. Freud in the milieu of Charcot or the psychiatrists. And at that time, Freud was in his 30s, was not thinking as yet of psychoanalysis. He was only convinced that with cocaine he could cure every disease. And which allowed me to make him to say, I don't think that I will be concerned with sex in my activity as a psychiatrist. But he was informed of something similar to psychoanalysis, probably in the English milieu, because he speaks of talking cure in English. And he speaks accidentally of that talking cure, and Simonini is inspired to since he doesn't think to confess his life to a Jew, to a Jewish doctor, he tries to recover what he has partly forgot by keeping a diary. Because, in fact, he has not the impression of having forgotten something. But he realizes that there are certain days of his life that are empty. And at the same time, in the same diary, there is another strange Abbot della Piccola making interventions, and the lector is suggested to suspect that probably Simonina and Della Piccola are the two sides of the same person, but it is not so sure, even because there is a third Della Piccola making an intervention. Okay, I want to reveal all the tricks of this abominable novel.
Now, one thing that is very prominent in the book is food. And there are really some wonderful recipes in this book.
That was one of my mistakes. I tell you why. I gave Simonini all this food as a substitute for sex. He has no sexual activities. And each of these recipes, I made a very serious research when he goes in the restaurant so-and-so and he eats the recipe so-and-so, it is because I found the menu of that restaurant in that historical moment. Each of these recipes is in itself marvelous, and the names are so... But altogether, they should disgust the reader. On the contrary, the readers were fascinated by the names of all those delicatessen.
This book, we should say, has already sold millions of copies. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones 800-433-8850. We have some callers waiting, 800-433-8850. Good morning, Michael. He's in
Good morning,
Eagle,
Diane.
North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a huge fan of Mr. Echoes. And
thanks.
I just wanted to point out to all the listeners that if they get a chance, read Foucault's Pendulum. It is I consider it one of the best books I've ever written or read, and it's far, far superior to the Da Vinci Code, and especially your meticulous research. And I thought maybe you could touch on how you researched that book. It's fascinating.
Well, you know, the researches are fundamental for me, not because I want to be faithful to some historical truth, but because it is so amusing to spend 6 or 8 years, as it happened for the Foucault's Pendulum, researching all the material. This is the nice aspect of the whole story. When the book is finished, you have lost every pleasure. That's for the research. The research that I was collecting, all this occult material that you can find in various bookstores and so, and it was the same that 20 years later was collected by Dan Brown. With a small difference, my book is the grotesque representation of those who believe all that trash. While the book of Dan Brown, I don't know if he believes or not, but makes the readers to believe all that. So they make pilgrimage to the Saint-Sulpice, to Rennes-le-Château. That is the difference. So that once I met Dan Brown, and I said, joking, you are one of my characters. You are one of the characters of the Foucault's Pendulum.
But how did you feel about his book?
About the Foucault's
Dan Brown's book.
Oh, okay. I am not here to speak of the Dan Brown books. I thought it's using all this material, taking it seriously. While I used all that material, looking at it grotesquely, and so with a critical mind and with a lot of irony. Well, let's say the Da Vinci Code lacks irony.
It lacks irony.
And irony is fundamental for it.
And you also believe that laughter is very important.
Oh, laughter is always important because sometimes it can be destructive, and so you can use it as a critical weapon. Sometimes it's only an aspect, positive aspect of life. So, but you know, we laugh because we are happy, and sometimes we laugh because we are unhappy. And so,
but were you flattered or annoyed that Dan Brown had used so much of what you had written in Foucault's pen?
But it was public material. You can buy it everywhere.
You can buy it everywhere.
The world is full of people believing in the Holy Grail, in the Templars are still among us, and so forth. And what is typical of this material is that they are repeating each other from book to book, because people will believe only what they already know.
The Prague Cemetery is the title of Umberto Eco's newest book. We'll take a short break and be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes in communities worldwide and supporting World Diabetes Day, novonordisk-us.com. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, celebrating 20 years of being a source for what works in education. More at edutopia.org. And by CenturyLink, providing broadband, entertainment, and voice products to Americans coast to coast. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. This is NPR.
Life is only on Earth, and not for long.
Kirsten Dunst stars in the new psychological drama Melancholia, about depression and the end of the world. On the next Fresh Air, Dunst talks about making the film and working with the controversial director Lars von Trier. Join us.
And we'll go right back to the phones. Your questions for Umberto Eco, his newest novel, The Prague Cemetery. Now to Michael in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning. Professor Eco, I actually saw your three lectures at Oxford in the 1990s.
Ah.
Which I loved. I loved your comments on Dante's quest for the perfect language.
Yeah.
And I think your concept, I haven't read The Prague Cemetery, but I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm wondering whether you are warning us in the form of a metaphor about processes that actually could be taking place today within our own vastly expanded security services.
Yes, when writing this story taking place in the 19th century, I was in the very moment of writing, convinced that I was telling something about people who is living now. And I could, you know, I would like my readers go around with this novel as with a guide, with a Baedeker, saying, oh, that is a Simonini, that one is another Simonini. This world is full of concoctors, producer of fake dossier, and so he's a permanent menace. In particular, all the protocols of the Elders of Sion is an interesting case of something which has been proved false in 1921, and it continues to be taken seriously. I don't mention the Arab countries in which it's sold everywhere and present in every public library, and you can even understand it's a state of war. But even in the Western world, and it's enough to surf a little on internet, and you find a lot of sites that provide you still with the material of the protocol. So, well, a novel should never have an educational purpose. But this time I was tempted to attribute to it even an educational purpose.
Does that answer it, Michael?
It does. Could I follow it up
sure.
with another question? If there are, of course, there are many people who are multiplying the protocols of the Elders of Zion. But what about all of the, you talk about the Arab countries, but what about all of the other websites that are stigmatizing Islam and the problem of Islamophobia? Do you think that is also a problem?
But, you know, internet is a strange form of global encyclopedia in which you can find a site that tells you that 2 plus 2 makes 4 and sites that tell you that 2 plus 2 makes 5. In my example, the opposition is very clear. One is wrong. But it's very difficult even for a young person to identify the reliability of a site. And so very easy to fall on a, let's say, a negationist site without knowing that it is so, and so you have. So internet can be controlled. That is a form of democracy, but it's also a form, a risk for our time. We should teach people how to filter information.
Thanks for calling, Michael. Here's an email from Sig, who says, today is the 10th of November. November 10, 1938, I was a 12-year-old boy in Vienna and witnessed the attacks on Jews. My father was threatened with a pistol by Hitler Youth, and through the intervention of Christian neighbor of Czech origin, I and my father were saved. Mr. Umberto Eco is also very appropriate. After my liberation from Buchenwald, I needed medical care and received it in orthopedic hospitals in Italy. Any Jewish person who reached the Partigiani was safe and protected. Thank you for the guest and the subject.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you to you. It is true that when Mussolini proclaimed the racist laws in 1938, because it was practically obliged by Hitler, the Italian people didn't follow it so much. So that what this gentleman is saying is true. A lot of Italians helped the Jewish people. But, well, there were also the racists in Italy. There was a very important journal, La Difesa della Razza, which was a terrible racist magazine full of crazy theory. And racism is always present. Italians believe not to be racist because there were no black people in Italy. No? Suddenly, with the immigration, Italy is full of black people, but even of white people from Romania, Albania, and the Italians have become racist. So there is a battle always open. We cannot never sit down and say, oh, that's solved. No, the evil is always there.
To Casnovia, New York. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, Mr. Echo. I wanted to comment on your comment that the protocols of the Zion of Elder begins with the dishonesty of this fictional meeting of rabbis to plot to take over the world. And it called to mind to me immediately the impossibly wrong, dishonest premise of Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, in which the character of Shylock demands the pound of flesh from another human being. I mean, literally, the pound of flesh, which is, of course, an entire violation of any kind of Jewish law. And I wondered if you might comment on the Shakespeare play and its impact on Western civilization through the spread of the English-speaking civilization. And I'll take your comment off the air. Thank you.
Hold on a minute. Do you understand the question?
It was called Shylock and the impact of what? Of the Shakespearean... listen, in England, it happened the worst because one of the most ferocious stories, anti-Semite stories, is in the... far before Shakespeare in the Tales of Canterbury, in which is told the story of this young Christian boy who was killed by the Jews in order to use his blood for their rites. And it is another pattern, which initially was not attributed to Jews, but to the heretics. Then it was attributed to Muslims, then to Jews, and even to communists. Russian communists eat babies, so it's a permanent pattern. So the anti-Semitism of the Canterbury Tales was more ferocious and probably more effective than the one of Shakespeare, because I must confess that the psychology of Shylock is multifaceted. Shakespeare is not hating Shylock. He's trying to understand his psychology. So it's a little less than the many other texts.
Here's an email from Henry at the University of Michigan. Mr. Echo will note that since its authorship, the Protocols has attracted enormous numbers of believers across Europe, the United States, and still today in many parts of the world. What do we learn by trying to imagine its creator rather than focusing on its readership?
Apropos of its readership, there is a note I put at the end in which I quote the book of Henri Rollin, L'Apocalypse de Notre Temps, in which it says that the protocols were, when he wrote in 39 the book, the most widely circulated work in the world after the Bible. I cannot try to explain the fortune of this text. And I prefer to tell the story of his creation. Because maybe, first of all, they reinforce pre-existing prejudice. Okay, I always quote the position of an anti-Semite, Nesta Webster, that in 1924 wrote a book after on the secret society and the plot paranoia, and she knew that the protocols were proved to be false, and she concludes by saying, okay, maybe they are a fake, but since they say exactly what the Jews think, they are true. So, you see, when the prejudice is there, you always use a text to reinforce your prejudice. So I think that the problem is not the existence of the protocols. The problem is the permanence of the racial prejudice and of antisemitism. If it were not the protocols, it would have been another text. The protocols worked very well because they are out of hinges, disconnected. You can do with them everything. It's like the horror picture show. You can do what do you want with them because they have no coherence, no structure. So you can use one page, another. In this sense, they are very, very, very useful to reinforce prejudices.
Does it concern you that these protocols are somehow alive and well?
Yes. Certainly, certainly. They are there. You can buy them everywhere. You can find them in many versions on internet. You know, in Germany, for historical reasons you can understand, it is forbidden to publish either the protocols or Hitler's Mein Kampf. So my German translator had problems because when in my novel I quote pages of the protocols, it didn't have a German translation. But then it was enough to surf a little on internet, and he found there all the German translations of the protocol needed. So it's for me, it's stupid to forbid the publication of a book like that. They should make a critical edition with comments.
To be understood.
Yes, to explain what they are, how they are born.
Umberto Eco, and the book we're talking about is The Prague Cemetery, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's hear from Connie here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. The book sounds fascinating. I just wanted to suggest that the readers also take the time as they can to get to Prague and visit the real Prague Jewish Cemetery, which is also near the old synagogue. It's fascinating. There's tombstones on top of tombstones. I believe Kafka is buried there, too, if I remember correctly. It's absolutely a fascinating addition to this book, which sounds like a book I've got to go out and buy.
It was very low.
She talked about visiting the Prague Cemetery herself and how beautiful it is.
Okay. You know, in my novel, Prague is never visited and not mentioned. When there was the first informations about the title of my book, I was invited in Prague, and they said, "Listen, I am not speaking of Prague, unfortunately, because it's a city I love. The real Jewish cemetery is a masterpiece. It is a sort of natural masterpiece because the accumulation of the tombs, one upon the other. It's like a mouth with the teeth, very disordered before being cured, and it's absolutely fascinating. And I think that even that miserable Goethe had visited the cemetery and thought of it under the moon in a stormy night. It was a perfect theater for a sort of horror show."
I want to ask you about what's happening in Italy. We've had an AP report that the concerns about Italy are easing somewhat as Italian politicians voice support for a government led by Mario Monti. He's experienced in global financial circles. What do you think?
I have no economic competence. I realize that there is a problem, an economical problem to be solved, even though I should say the Italian society is more affluent than its government. There are a lot of small enterprises, it's a vast structures. But okay, we have to solve an important The case of Berlusconi was of a premier was not taken seriously by the other European leaders, and that it was a tragedy. If he resigns, Mario Monti is a very respectable person that will not solve the crisis in 2 days, but they will put again Italy in a normal relationship with the other governments, because Berlusconi had lost any reliability and he had to be eliminated. Yeah. If he resigns, because he gives the impression to be like Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, it's shooting in order not to be finally captured.
You feel he will step down?
Yes, but the moment he steps down, he will have a very serious judiciary problems. That's why he's trying desperately to resist.
Umberto Eco, his newest novel, The Prague Cemetery. Wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for
being here. It's wonderful also for me. Thank you, Dan.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from